ESCOM, I think, has covered quite well the proximate causes, what I'd call the immediate causes for the blackouts on January the 18th. What I'll do is just briefly recap those, but not spend time on that. I think what's more interesting is to understand what are root causes, or what are ultimate causes behind this, because then it helps us begin to address some of the broader policy issues and broader monitoring and management issues to prevent this happening in the future, and at least to restore a degree of electricity security in the country. So I think it's clear what happened. Approximately 50 gigawatt hours of electricity were not supplied. What hasn't received perhaps quantitative treatment is that the overall economic cost of that was very significant. ESCOM estimates the cost of unserved energy to be about 75,000 rand per megawatt hour, and that is more or less a 3.7 billion rand hit to the economy. So these are clearly very important issues. What actually happened, as we saw from the presentation from Mr. Kavashi, there was a shortfall of about 2,800 megawatts. Nearly 5,000 megawatts was actually out on planned maintenance, but a further unplanned nearly 5,000 megawatts became unavailable. And that was almost 13 units. About 8 of them came off completely, and another 5 or so had to reduce power. In addition, it seemed that actual demand for that day and for that week was higher than had been forecast. Normally, ESCOM would manage a situation like this through squeezing extra power out of its plants, through making sure that it had maximum imports and emergency reserves through its gas turbines and pump storage and hydro, and also through demand-side measures and interrupt clauses. It used those to the maximum, and despite that, then still had to cut power. So it's clear what actually happened. Let's think now and try and understand what would be the underlying causes. And I want to deal firstly with two causes, reasons which are quite often put forward, which I believe, in fact, don't explain what happened. The first is that we've been caught out by higher than expected economic growth, and that's translated into higher electricity demand growth. In fact, when you look at the figures and the data, they don't actually support that premise. Both ESCOM and the regulator have been remarkably accurate, I think, in forecasting electricity demand. I looked at the plans that were done in 2001 and 2003 and 5 and 6, and in fact, they're pretty spot on where our demand was at the end of last year. Where we might see a difference, and I think this is important, is that this might not be the case in the future. We are beginning to see the beginning of accelerated growth, certainly in the month and a half this year, of being higher than actually predicted. So this could be a big issue in the future, which makes an accelerated expansion plan very critical. The second reason that I've sometimes seen argued in the press is that the regulator is somehow responsible because either licenses were refused or delayed, or they didn't allow necessary capital expenditure, or they gave ESCOM price increases which were too low and so they weren't able to finance an expansion program. In fact, the regulator had to declare an interest for a seven-year period during that time. I've looked at the record. I see no record of the NER either delaying or not providing a license. That's in the past. This could well be an issue in the future, and I'll come back to it later, because the procedures for new licensing are becoming increasingly complicated and may actually be a significant issue in the future. This issue of price increases, yes, the regulator did award prices that were lower than those that asked for, but nevertheless, ESCOM's financial position right through this period has been incredibly strong. It's reduced its net debt to practically zero, has a very strong balance sheet as a basis for the new program. So I think obstruction by the regulator or lack of finance aren't reasons for explaining where we are. What are the real reasons? Well, I've been delighted to actually hear from GPE this morning recognition of this, of what in effect is the real cause. It was true that between 1998, from the, when the White Paper on Energy Policy was published, and 2004, there was a great deal of policy uncertainty. A cabinet memo in 2001 actually prevented Eskom from building, and we had this critical period between 2001 and 2004 where there was this IA exit. The expectation was that private power would come in. In fact, nothing was done to implement, to facilitate that, and that's important. It's not so much that the policy was necessarily wrong. The policy wasn't actually implemented, and so the legislation wasn't in place, contracting, the competitive tenders, all those necessary steps to get private sector in didn't happen in that period. Fortunately, in October 2004, the DPE minister announced that cabinet had now tasked Eskom to take responsibility, particularly for the 70%, 30% would still be allocated to the private sector, but in effect to begin, once again become the supplier of last resort. I think there's another reason which has not received much attention in the press, but which I think is highly relevant. The 30% which is reserved for the private sector, is that program has been run by the Departments of Minerals and Energy, and it's way behind initial timelines. The latest estimates are that that first gas turbine that they are putting out to bid would only be able to come online in 2009. In fact, my estimate is unless those contracts are awarded by mid-year, it's even likely that we will miss the 2009 deadline, which means that a whole opportunity to shore up our capacity in this critical next five-year period has effectively been missed. This applies specifically in the first instance to the open cycle gas turbines, but it also applies to the new IPP, which evidently Cabinet has authorized DME to go out on tender for, and that is a closed cycle gas turbine at Cooker using LNG. The plan suggests that this should be in place by 2009. Is that true? LNG is liquefied natural gas, so it's a way of transporting gas to our shores. It would then need to be regasified. That plant is a very important one because it enables at least mid-merit and perhaps even base load, which is the real need in that 2009-11 period. And I think most independent analysts would say there's almost no chance of that IPP coming online in 2009. A third reason, while there's been a great deal of planning, in fact, all the way through this policy hiatus, planning continued, it could be argued that some of the planning assumptions that went in perhaps were not optimal. And I've given some suggestions here. I think we're too optimistic around plant availability. Actual plant availability has been lower. And although those percentages don't look very significant, they translate into hundreds of megawatts. One of the earlier plans, the crucial plans, assumed that too much availability from municipalities. In fact, the amount available from them has been declining quite significantly. Earlier plans used interruptible contracts as part of the core planning allowances. Later plans, fortunately, have said that could only be used in emergency. And critically, I think we used far too low costs of unserved energy. The outages in the West Cape last year showed that those costs are in fact much higher. Eskom has now adjusted those numbers. The effect of all of this, though, critically, was that there was a period where it was thought that 10% reserve margins would be optimal. In hindsight, it's clear that we needed much, much higher margins to ensure security of supply. Just an example to show how tight the system has been over this last year. You would have seen a figure of peak demand earlier presented of about 34,800. In fact, that was after demand-side measures and interruptible contracts. If you say what the real demand was, It was actually on 25th of May, and it amounted to 35,400 megawatts. And you can see that the only way that that was met, we had some plants out on maintenance, so we only had 33,000 available of generating capacity. We had to use all our imports, and then we had to use quite significant demand-side measures. In other words, companies being paid to switch off power, a very effective and efficient market, and then interruptible loads. And there's a general lesson here that, and it's really reinforced by the slide shown to us by the CEO earlier, is that in the next period, we have a very, very tight demand and supply situation. There's a lot of detailed figures there, but I just want to draw your attention to that middle column, which shows the deficit. So this compares, reviews the winter period for last year. It shows what was forecast, and it shows actual, and it shows, if you look at that last colored column there, where ideally we should be in the green all the time. In fact, only 4 weeks over that period were relatively safe, where we had enough operating reserves and enough allowances for unplanned capacity. The rest of the time was very tight and were met only by implementing these demand-side measures and declaring emergency level one, etc. So just to re-emphasize this point, the fact that new capacity takes time to put online, particularly base load, a minimum of 4 years once you get on site, means that even though we commit a number of investment decisions now, we're not going to get relief before 2011. And I think we have to understand this. For the next 5 years, we will remain with a very, very tight situation. I won't spend much time on this. This is the kind of standard plans of ESCOM expansion plans, where we add firstly the return to service, some DSM capacity, build new peaking gas plants, pump storage plants, and then new base plant, and eventually we result in a situation where reserve margins can be improved. This is just another way of representing it. It looks like a complicated table. It's quite simple. The left-hand column just shows the year in which new plant will come on, and then the figures in the table show the amount of megawatts that come on in those particular years from different sources. And just to summarize quickly, the initial emphasis is obviously on returning to service the mothball plants. We heard some of the progress reports on that today, how that program is being accelerated. The very, very good progress on the initial gas peaking plant here at Atlantis and Mossel Bay, and attempts now to double that up through the Gas One project. Unfortunately, that next circle I show you is the DME IPP. I think quite significant risks around that, as well as risks around any combined cycle gas plant, private plant also being tendered by DME for Cooker. The peaking plant for pump storage seems to be on track. We've all heard these big investment decisions have been made around new baseload coal-fired plants, the Timber B, Project Alpha and Charlie. New investment decisions will now be made in March by the ESCOM board, including potentially around new nuclear, as we've seen in the press. So a massive amount of attention to those new investment decisions, but I stress again the point that that capacity can only come in after a significant lead time. So we still have this very tight situation in the short term. And you can see even the standard plan here, that reserve margin doesn't even rise to 15% if all these investments are taken into account. ESCOM's aware of that, obviously. Has a stretched program trying to squeeze further megawatts out of existing capacity. There's a lot of potential to contract in cogeneration. That means industrial customers that have steam might be able to generate additional power. For example, Sasol could generate an additional 600 megawatts. Huge potential, I think, to get some of that power on board as well. We heard about ESCOM's plans to significantly expand the DSM program, very important, full utilization of non-ESCOM generation, accelerating commissioning of capacity. Maybe we might need even further peaking plants if some of the risks emerge. And I think the comes really to the role of the shareholder DPE and the role of this committee, that these programs are incredibly important if supply security is to be improved, and we need to track progress. So, Mr. Chairman, let me conclude and then just make a few brief recommendations. It's clear, and I think no one would dispute that, that South African security of supply is inadequate. I think we all understand now the immediate causes, approximate causes. They've been laid out well today, and we know the root causes of the approximate causes of the previous West Cape outages. But we now need to address some of the root causes. And it's clear that while maybe some of the planning assumptions, particularly in the early 2000s, might have been less than optimal, the root causes was this policy uncertainty and the prohibition on Eskom building new capacity. Supply security in the short term is in the main being taken care of by Eskom. And in my view, I think they're probably doing all that is possible. I've been into Eskom. There's some extraordinarily good people who are working incredibly hard at all levels. Ehud Mathieu, this generation executive director, his staff in making sure that existing plants operate to their maximum. The system operator who tries to balance demand and supply. People are doing an extraordinary job there. And there are all sorts of new quality and reliability programs in Eskom that are really trying to do the best. The issue, in my view, then, is the medium term. And the issues there are not so much Eskom. The issues essentially are the enabling environment, which allows both Eskom and the private sector to make the necessary investments. And so, if we come to recommendations, some of these may be beyond the purview of this committee, and it's a pity it's not a joint sitting between this committee and Minerals and Energy, but could some of these areas fall into DME's domain. But the first thing, and this point was very much emphasized by that security of supply study which DPE commissioned and which is now in the public domain, we need an explicit security standard. This is not a trivial issue, it's not a simple issue. It needs to be studied properly. It needs to be based on a proper assessment of probability of loss of load, but also the cost of unserved energy, and to come then to a realistic reserve margin. We need then to hold institutions accountable to that. We need to monitor it. I think the regulator can play a very important role. And it needs to be reported. Standard process internationally is that utilities report progress on security of supply against standards, and this should be in the public domain. I think the second issue, and it's an issue that I think is of absolute and critical importance, is that we need to coordinate and integrate our planning processes. At the moment, we have two completely separate processes, perhaps even three, one inside Eskom, one in the regulator, and one in DME. We don't have the resources, we don't have the capacity to be running separate processes. It results in decision-making uncertainty and confusion. A clear recommendation, and it was also a recommendation of that security of supply support of DPEs, is that you need to fold these planning processes into one. It obviously makes sense to then anchor this around Eskom's planning processes. They are by far the best resourced. And most detailed and complex. The issue then is to locate that capacity in an institutional space which gives all stakeholders some confidence. And this might not be the most convenient for Eskom, but to me the most what makes the most sense is to locate this planning close to the system operator. I know the system operator is primarily responsible for short-term security supply, but it could easily be extended to medium-term. It's a good location in the sense that it's at the heart of the industry, and it allows some possibility at a later stage to create actually an independent system operator. The third issue, which is beginning to surface and which could create significant delays, is that we are not integrating the approval processes for new investment capacity Eskom board makes a decision. Under the PFMA, it gets a shareholder to approve. It then has to get licensing approval. The regulator doesn't license anything that is not in the plan. The legislation says anything's not in the plan needs a motivation to the minister to why there should be deviation from the plan. DME has responsibility to decide around new generation capacity. These processes are not being brought together, and there's a real potential for serious delays and frustration, even confusion, because we're seeing in some instances decisions being made which are not transparent. It's not clear to me how the decision was made that the combined cycle gas turbine at Cooker should be run as an IPP process by DME. In fact, my sources indicate that Eskom was not even in the decision-making loop for that. And so they have to manage quite a risky process. What happens if that plant doesn't come in on time? What contingencies does Eskom have to put in place to meet supply? And this then comes to the issue of how you then manage private participation in power. We've seen that the current processes aren't working very well. I think we need to institutionalize the procurement process. The most obvious way is to create a single buyer office, ideally placed alongside the planning process, perhaps initially next to the system operator, maybe in time next to an independent system operator. These are issues which may seem not urgent, but in my view they are urgent because they create the enabling environment in which investment decisions can be made in a timely and efficient manner to guarantee security of supply in the medium term. So, Chairman, I want to end by one issue which I was glad was raised in passing by the CEO of Eskom. We are concentrating here on the security of supply issues in relation to generation capacity. In many respects, the necessary attention has been given to this, certainly in the next 5 years, and if these policy issues are addressed in the medium term. The issues, in my view, that where we run the greatest risk in security of supply are increasingly on the distribution side of the industry. We've heard that the uncertainties and delays in creating the REDs have means that particularly municipalities are not investing in systems, people, maintenance, new systems. This has been independently verified by audits commissioned by the regulator, and unless this process is sorted out and fast-tracked, we will be seeing more blackouts at the regional level. I thank you for your attention.
Peter, and then other people will pose questions. Any other hands up?
Yeah. Chair, thank you very much. And I think so far today has been a very useful exercise. And thank you for inviting Professor Eberhardt also. Because it's very difficult for us as lay people to take on people as intelligent as the CEO and the chairperson of Eskom, who know so much more than us. just on that last point about investment in human capacity and so on, and the CEO spoke about the 32,000 hardworking, loyal people. Is Eskom doing enough to keep them loyal and keep them happy? There was a recall of the so-called boat incident. One of the issues raised by the minister was staff unhappiness. How far has that matter been dealt with? And then just some other questions, Chairperson. Question of solar came from the CEO's input. Solar geysers for houses. Now, I mean, there's proposals, some people suggesting that all new buildings come in with solar heaters that be made compulsory. Now, as a homeowner, if I decide to put in a solar geyser, I look at the cost. And I said, look, it's quite a large layout for me, and I'm not going to actually see me saving money over the next 6 to 10 years. For Eskom, it's not a question of how much money I'm saving, it's a question of how much electricity can be saved. Are you looking at a program where you, like you did with the lights, with the energy efficient light bulbs, an exchange program of assisting people in addressing that or to change? Your schedules, when you publish your schedules, very complicated or time-consuming to read. I, for example, have no idea which area I fall in terms of Eskom. I stay in Welgelegen. Now when I have to read that whole page in the newspaper, and then I see here's a Welgelegen part one, and then lower down I see there's a Welgelegen part two, and I don't know what area I mean. Maybe an approach would be either to put these suburbs in alphabetical order, so you know where to go look for your area. Alternatively, have a municipalities when they send out their accounts, that they put on there which ESCOM area you fall in, or generation area, what you call distribution area you're in. So you know straight away when you have to make your sacrifices. Your servitude problems. What kind of problems are there? Is it not being able to purchase the land? Is it private people? Is it government departments? Because we're oftentimes it's government departments that don't cooperate with one another. And have you looked at the making use of expropriation? Where it comes to, like you talked about, 10 kilometers delaying a project. And the reduction in stockpiles. So, what was the cause in the reduction? Is it the inability of Transnet to deliver that coal? Because Transnet says, no, they've got more than sufficient capacity. Or there are other reasons. Thank you, sir.
You know, there's so many questions.
One other thing, sorry, sir. The nuclear plant, now I'm a bit confused because what Professor Everard is saying, it looks like it might be a private producer that supplies electricity to Kuka. I know one of the possible sites for a nuclear plant is Station Spandeer in the Eastern Cape. Now, oftentimes, especially these Earth-like people and others, they're always scaring people with nuclear energy. I've never heard that. What are the advantages? For example, if a nuclear plant is built in Port Elizabeth instead of on the West Coast, what would be the advantages in terms of the local economy, in terms of job creation? Or are they minor for the area in which they are located?
There's lots of questions. Can we just take that set of questions? Instead of structuring it and saying, you know, we're dealing with different sections of the input, I think let people, because of the nature, let people just ask what they want to ask, okay? And then we'll, because there's so many questions, Tulani, Bari, you want to respond? How do you want to manage it? You want to say something first? Yeah, well, I think we just let's take the questions. You put your, you signal that you wanted to respond in particular.
I wanted to just respond to what Professor Everard said about the IPPs. I thought it's an important thing for the committee to think about and to know. What sparked my response was when he said that Eskom was partly responsible for the delays in the IPPs. Partly true, but there's a whole story around that. The theory is that it's good for the private sector to build power stations, and that the country should allow private sector to build power stations. One, because the private sector is said to be more efficient, will bring in interesting technologies. The taxpayer won't take the risk because some capitalist is going to put up the money, and those sorts of things. It will improve competitiveness. Those are some of the reasons why you would do that sort of thing. Now, I have a theory that the private sector is actually not fighting. That's my theory. The private sector is not coming in to build power stations. From an Eskom point of view, I think we would be extremely happy if anybody decided to build a power station and sell it to Peter Hendrick, sell the power to anybody. It would be a good thing, because as you can see, we're able to supply the market comfortably. So it will be a very good thing, will ease off some of the things. The problem, however, is that if a private person builds a power station, he won't be able to sell that power at the price that Eskom can sell the power. Because Eskom can sell power cheaply for a variety of reasons, much cheaper than anybody else. So in other words, that person is going to be he's going to have to sell it more, so Peter won't buy his power. It's a simple thing. So then, what that person would want is some sort of way in which the end user can get it at a reasonable price, but that he can get paid the price which will allow him to make the profit. So now here you have the IPP. Government says people come, we want to build IPP. So the private sector comes and says, okay, we'll build a power station, but promise us that you will always buy our power. So in other words, that the market element now is taken out. They want to promise up front for so many years you will buy the power. They want to promise on the price that you will pay us so much so that we can make a profit and pay back the debt which we're going to raise. And the private sector generally has to pay more for money than Eskom would. Because Eskom raises money very cheaply because, as the professor said, it's got excellent finances, excellent balance sheet. If it goes to Europe, it can raise money more cheaply than, you know, Anglo-American can or anybody else. So you can get cheaper money to build a park, so it's going to cost more. So they want that to be taken into account for what they get paid. Then what the interested parties generally have been hinting at is that if something really goes wrong, we don't want to lose our money, then Eskom must promise to buy the power station from us. So that those sorts of things have been coming in. And when this thing, the reason I'm responding is when it came to the board of Eskom said, this is ridiculous. You know, there's no entrepreneurship that's coming in here. Why don't we just do it ourselves? Because we can raise money cheaply, the end user will be better off, the consumer will be better off. And so you can say it's a delay from the Eskom side, but if, you know, there's this ridiculous requirement, I mean, certainly I'm not going to, frankly, under my watch, agree to those sorts of things. But we certainly want the private sector to come in an entrepreneurial sort of manner, in a manner which will bring in competitiveness, which will bring in the market, etc. And so that's just what I would say. It's a bit of a complicated thing. My own theory is, don't hold your breath. I don't think that the private sector is going to come in. You know, you build a big power station of 2,000 megawatts or 3,000 megawatts, it has a lifespan of 70 years. These people don't have the appetite for something that's as long as that. They want to see, you know, if you buy shares on the stock exchange units, you want to see what your profits are going to be in 5 years' time, not in 60 years' time or something of that sort. So don't hold your breath. It's not going to happen that easily. I think that that for the foreseeable future, Eskom, our view is that Eskom must take on the burden of doing that. And we can't, we'll be doing a very dangerous thing if we assume that 30% of our needs is going to come from the private sector. If it comes, it would be wonderful. But we must move ahead and strengthen ourselves to try to take on this burden, which is the sort of mindset that we've got.
That partly they would rather, even the private sector is interested, they'd rather invest in China or India or whatever. I got that sense somewhere I read, you know, that they're not going to be so attracted to South Africa. But maybe there's a journalist observing it who doesn't really have the technical know-how. Anton, you want to respond to the issue?
Chairman, I think there are a number of reasons why it would be a good idea to bring in the private sector at least for a portion of new capacity. It serves as a very useful benchmark against Eskom performance. And yes, while Eskom correctly says the cost of capital for the private sector is higher, what they would argue is perhaps they can do things more efficiently. We don't know. I mean, that has to be shown. So that their prices might be competitive with what Eskom's new plant would be. Obviously not its average price, because it has a lot of old plant that it's paid for. So I think it's an interesting benchmark. I think my own understanding is that there is a fair amount of interest from the private sector. We've seen it in these open cycle gas turbines, where at the initial conference for expressions of interest, it was very well attended. Five consortia, very strong consortia with well-known international players, both from industrialized countries but also from places like India, expressed very strong interest. The key impediment at the moment is the enabling environment, including dealing with some of the thorny issues raised by Vali around what are the terms and conditions in that offtake agreement with Eskom. But it can be done. The rest of Africa has something like 40 independent power projects spanning across 10, 12 countries in much more difficult investment climates than ours. I can tell you many of those investors would much prefer to invest in this country than many of those other countries that they've invested in. So I stress again, I think the enabling environment, the legislation, the tendering process, the contracting arrangements need to be adequate for that investment to show itself.
Comment on this IPP aspect. It's something else. We'll come back to this. On the IPP.
I think it might be useful, if not today, but at a later stage, you get some more information about that PPIs, what IPPs, on the rest of the continent, just to see how it is. Because some of us, I don't think we're quite sure how this independent producer is supposed to operate.
This falls mainly under DME and that other committee, our colleagues, their comrades there. But, you know, I think let's leave it for now. You see, it's a very, whatever the validity of each argument, it's the first time we've heard that actually, you know, I did business there. That's my source. I don't have a researcher. Well, now that Eric Boskowski, he's a young man, and he's acquiring, you know, he's only been here for less than 3 months. Right, but you know, so Business Day until now has been saying that there is a lot of interest, and here's the chairperson of the board saying, "Hey, don't hold your breath." This is a new insight, so you know it's helpful to ask. It gives us a complete.
See, the professor says there's a lot of interest. There is. Anybody would show an interest if you say, "Here's a business opportunity. We guarantee your profits. No risk involved." Who would show an interest in a thing like that? I mean, frankly. Any kind of business, whether it's power business or any business on earth. You know, I'm partly a businessman now. I would invest in any business where a person says you're guaranteed a profit and at no risk. Government will take all the risk. If something goes wrong, we'll pay you out at a profit. I mean, that's not even business. So, a lot of interest in doing it like that. But once you start saying, wait a minute, the whole thing about private sector is that you shift risk away to the private sector. That's what entrepreneurship is about. That's when you start getting, you know, frankly, people scuttling. And so, you know, that's what we're going to have to see, whether you get that sort of thing. So it's fine to go to some smaller country with a weaker administration and with not a powerful institution like Eskom and dictate your terms on which you will build a power station. You can do that. You can't dictate terms here. Because here you've got, you know, you've got powerful institutions to deal with, and you'll have to come in and really be competitive. And that's where I think that we're not going to have it going as fast as possible, not because of government problems, frankly, I must tell you. Not that government is always right and efficient and all this, but it's really because if a private sector really wants to take the risk and hold the power station, I believe they can do it. But they just want government to take the risk. And that's where the problem is coming in.
Chair, I think I owe it to you to be quick with time in answering these questions. Staff morale, I think the only comment I want to make is that it's been a very difficult time for staff because we've got to keep the system together and the conditions are never easy. You can imagine a call center person dealing with phone calls of angry customers all day. So we put a lot of effort into supporting people. And generally, I think there's a commitment that would make the morale, even though, you know, not as high as it should be, but people are definitely committed. And we're dealing with, you know, matters of ensuring that the issues are dealt with and everybody puts their shoulder to the wheel. You'll always have pockets of staff unhappiness in an organization with 32,000 employees. And I'm sure we won't have seen the last of it. But overall, I don't think there's a morale problem. I'm quite confident that we're seeing these results under these conditions because people are committed. The issue of solar geysers, I mentioned in my input that we've taken the proposal through the EXCO, it's going to the board in a short while, and will then be endorsed nationally as a program. So that means we have to also then get the approval of the shareholder and the right policy departments that are involved. And I cannot at this stage indicate what incentives or other forms of support will be available, because those have to be, you know, approved, negotiated and approved. And I hope that within a month or so we'll be able to talk about that. The issue of load sharing schedules, I agree with the problem you raise. We're continually working on trying to improve these. We know the shortcomings there, and it is in fact one area that where we can make a difference once we're in a situation like that, and that is notifying people timelessly and then keeping to those schedules. So there's a huge effort. We are working with municipalities across the country. I'd ask that I should receive a report by end of the month as to how far we are with that. We've been having interactions with municipalities right across. The issue of servitude, under the new act, the Electricity Regulation Act, expropriation is permissible, but the regulations are not yet published. So we're in a little bit of a hiatus between the old act and the new act, and we don't have the means by which to do expropriation. So we're stuck with negotiating, and this is what is taking long. As soon as those regulations are in place, we'll then be able to carry out the expropriations accordingly, so that, you know, we don't get these unnecessary delays in projects. Reduction in stockpiles. Our stockpiles are, maybe Mr. Michael would like to comment on that, but I pointed out some of the issues that contribute to stockpiles being lowered. But at the moment, we're not really sitting with a stockpile problem. It's potentially a risk. During the 18th?
Yeah,
no. We had no stockpile problems at all. On the 18th of January?
Well, not the 18th, but before that, or then
the... Well, you want to comment, sir?
Can I'm audible? Chair, the issue about stockpiles arises as the situation, especially when we have bad weather conditions. Because a lot of the mines and suppliers are using open cast methods, and some of them use underground mining methods. So if there's heavy rain, like we had any part of last year, some of those mines get flooded, and it's just difficult to get to move the coal. So as a result of that, then you have the mine underproducing, and we'd use up the stockpiles, and if it continues for a long period of time, it means we have to use the other transportation means. Yes, we do have railway transportation in certain cases, but it's definitely not sufficient, and it's not flexible enough to be able to deal with some of those issues when you have them happening very rapidly and quickly. So those are the issues that's really around the stockpile management, but we have been working very hard at ensuring that our stockpiles are able to deal with at least 2 to 3 months kind of problem.
You know what, my managers are very gentlemen, you know, this is the problem. What Peter is referring to is a report around that time of the 18th, which said that because ESCOM has now awarded transport contracts to black companies, they're not able to transport the coal quick enough because blacks are slow, and so therefore there isn't enough coal at the power station. Now this was a story from a company whose transport contract was not renewed. It's purely political things. It's got nothing to do with reality at all. That's what it was. And it's just somebody who was, unhappy. I just grumbled about it. But it's got nothing to do with it, as you have to know.
No, but Chairman, all the same, we do want to highlight it as a risk. One that we're managing. Then, lastly, the issue of the nuclear, there is no intention of that being an IPP. Certainly, that has not been discussed, the nuclear plant. It should not necessarily be an IPP. I don't think that's the intention. The issue of locational advantages, it's correct that a lot of the advantage will be during the construction phase, because these tend to be very huge power stations. But once it's running, you're probably down to about 500 people. Or thereabouts, if I were to use Quebec as a benchmark. So it's not a, I mean, it's an employer in that sense, but you have over 500 people there.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to first thank the presenters from ESCOM. Please gave us a very good presentation. It's going to help us a great deal in our constituency. I thank them, all of them. Yeah. By the way, James, is he with ESCOM? Okay, my first question would be, I'd like to know about the outages that occurred last year. The business sector was, there was an outcry from the business sector. Whose responsibility is it? And if it's yours, how are you handling that responsibility? The second question would be on the security of supply. Because I've just heard from the presentation that the DMD and the ESCOM are responsible. Is it not supposed to be NERSA that is responsible for the security of supply? Let me end the chat.
Thanks. At least now I'm no longer being cooked alive because of the overheating. Chair, my first question, but I'm also going to appreciate the presentation by all the presenters. But Chair, I just wanted to check whether it's not possible if there is a need, because you see, when the professor was presenting, there were some conclusions and recommendations. At one point, I would love to hear what is the ESCOM response on those recommendations and those conclusions as moving forward in that particular issue. The second issue, Chair, which was also at one point in one of the SABC radio stations, if I'm not mistaken, it was the issue in relation, although I'm not sure whether are we still exporting any electricity out of the country to other countries. Because, why I'm asking is because of the reserve margin which we are talking about in relation to continue exporting, if we still do that. But in that interview, there was an indication that there is a rearrangement with those countries that when needs be, the supply will be cut. But I just want to get clarity around that, that are we still able to do both supplying ourselves and also exporting what is problems which we are really dealing with. And what is the future plan around that particular issue of exporting electricity? The third one is in relation to the fast tracking of this building, new power station. What is the implication? What one will assume, I'm not an engineer or whatever, one would anticipate that when we initially said we'll build this period, we have considered a lot of issues. Quality and so on and so on. What then become an implication is aim of fast-tracking the building? Are we not taking risk with maybe 10 years, 5 years down the line, also come and hold us because we wanted to fast-track those buildings and so on, the building of those power stations? The last one says that what is coming out says that especially after even the professor has presented is that we seem to have to accept that we are going to live with the situation. I just want to check whether I'm reading the signal correct, that this problem of outages and so on, something we have to live with until we've got the additional capacity and so on. So I'm just raising that, Chair, so that the message becomes clear, because there's a lot of uncertainty in the public. Most people in the public, they think that this is just for temporary. It will go away as quick as possible, but I just want to check exactly whether I'm reading correct that we have to live with the situation for some time, so that we know how to communicate the right message out there. Thank you.
There we go. On the issue of the 70%, 30%, where does municipalities fit in this whole issue? Are they part of the 70% or the 30%? And my next question is, who is driving this 30%? Is it the Department of Mineral Energy or Public Enterprises? Is it solely the Department of Mineral Energy?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the one of the presenters said for the exploring alternative forms of energy. Is there any studies being done to LED technology? Light emitting diodes. It's apparently another form that's much cheaper, and especially with poor communities. And then the other one is regards to your CAPEX program. How do you inform, I mean, communities outside of your, the things and opportunities for them to tender? And then, especially in Mpumalanga, where we've got a lot of coal, you know, I've got instances where there are mines that are supplying Camden with coal, but those mines are sort of, the people living on the farm that the mine is on are sort of in dire straits with regards, you know, they're quite poor. Can Camden maybe, as companies for them, to assist this community in any way? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The first question was with regards to the responsibility for outages that have occurred. We have contractual arrangements between ourselves and the customers of supply. And we have said in the past, and we work on the basis that people ought to come forward and make a claim in light of that particular contract and to be dealt with in that way. Now, we have received some claims resulting from the Cape outages earlier last year, and those are in the process of being dealt with. I think really that's the answer to that. Secondly, who is responsible for security of supply? The issue is that the current act, the new act, places it in the Department of Minerals and Energy under that minister. We used to have an obligation to supply until the changes that we've spoken about were put into place. And where it made no sense to say with an obligation to supply that we can't build. So we're in a sense relieved of that obligation. But with the cabinet decision in 2004, that decision gave us again an obligation to make sure that power does become available. But the new act last year has now put that in the court of the Minister of Minerals and Energy. Our response to Professor Eberhard's conclusions and recommendations, I think I would prefer to give a considered response. Certainly on the recommendations we're supportive because we think they take it forward. They do address the root cause, and that must be dealt with urgently. Some of the conclusions, I think, you know, I would certainly have a different view. When it comes particularly to planning assumptions in the early 2000s and the issue of weather, our track record may be good, you know, on the demand growth over the long period. But within that are many cycles, that some of them related to commodity prices, and I think I would not draw such a conclusion, given that you have a lot of cyclical things happening along that fairly smooth-looking curve. But those issues do not impact the recommendations. I would be supportive of the recommendations.
Yeah, I think I was going to suggest this way out. You see, the point is we can't have these discussions hanging in the air. And then we come and meet with you 6 months from now and cover the same ground, James, due respect to what you had to say, right? But we can talk outside this meeting. So what we do is, I was going to suggest that if we can have a written reply, say within 7 days, to some of the recommendations that Anton, Professor Eberhard has proposed. And in particular, for example, you see, we haven't got the time now. This is new to the committee, this idea that, if I'm correct in understanding what you said, that actually ESCOM did forecast reasonably correctly. notwithstanding claims that, you know, the economic growth just spiraled upwards. Now, we can have a, that's a new argument here. It's interesting we'll have a reply to that in written form. And then what we should do, what I'm urging members, I'm a bit worried, you see, with asking questions, it's fine. We've got a bit of time. But at the end of this meeting, we have to have some practical decisions about where we take this discussion. Can members think about that? Because in the last 10 minutes, we're going to stop asking general questions. We're going to say, what is it we're going to do from now to take things forward? Okay. Sorry to be so wordy and verbose, but I'm a bit worried about the open-ended nature of the discussion.
With regards to exports to neighboring countries, I did refer earlier that we are part of the Southern African power pool, and that's a cooperative pool. We trade power on a daily basis. Some of it is on spot contracts, day-ahead kind of markets. Others are on long-term contracts, 5-7 years, reviewed every as and when they come to an end. This has been a very, very useful cooperative pool. It's the only example of a strong working power pool on the continent. And a lot of effort has gone into it. It enjoys the support of SADC member governments. It's recognized as one of the SADC institutions. And I think there's a lot of benefit to be gained. At a strategic level, what we have sought to gain is a system that is integrated, where in the northern part of SADC, it's mainly hydroelectricity. And in the southern part, it's coal-fired and nuclear. And in that way, you have a robust, integrated system that can, in the long term, provide excellent security for everybody. So the question is, are we still exporting? And the answer is yes, we do export in line with the contracts that we have. Now, some of those contracts are for firm power, that is to say, continuous power as and when required. Others are what we call non-firm, which means when we have a shortage, we don't supply. If we have a surplus, we supply. But even that being the case, once there's a complete shortfall in our system, the rules of the power pool allow us to declare an emergency. So we tell all the utilities in SADC that we have an emergency, and we're no longer able to supply those firm contracts. But having said that, total sales under such contracts would amount to about 3% of our total sales. So it is not a huge amount that will make a massive difference. And that's the approach we take. We believe we must work with our colleagues in the region because in the longer term, this is what is going to be helpful to everybody. I've also spoken that some of our short-term contingency measures are to look at increasing what we can import from the region. So that's really the position on that. Implication of fast-tracking, the issues of quality, we're very concerned about this because the impacts are actually worse if you have a plant that in the end will not function because you cut corners, as it were. We really do focus on this, and I don't believe that with any of the projects at this stage there is such a risk or a threat to those projects. We'll continue to monitor that, and we'll in fact we would rather come forward and say the projects will not be delivered as we thought they would be, because accelerating them is compromising safety or quality of work that has to be done. So we'll try by all means, and I think it's our duty. I'm certainly sure that our board would be very keen on monitoring that we do not, you know, endanger either people or the proper function of the plant at a later stage. The issue of whether we now have to live with the situation, we've tried to convey as accurately as possible what the situation is. And in my view, we need to accept that we cannot meet all contingencies all the time, given the level of reserve margin. But I would also then say, if we make a concerted effort as a utility to keep the program that we have, the plans that we shared, to look for other opportunities, whether it be co-generation from other companies or importing more from the region, But what the public and customers can do is also start using electricity efficiently, which would then cut out wastage and would mean that we are then able to have more power to supply the needs of the market, which also has a benefit, an added benefit of saving the environment. Would actually not be burning the extra coal that we would have to burn if in fact we start using the product far more efficiently. The question of whether Munich fit, the major program we speak of is largely generation and transmission. Of the 97 billion, at least about 75, 80 is in fact in the transmission and, more like 75 is in the transmission and generation area. The balance is what we are doing in our distribution network. The point that's been made is that the Munichs ought to be making a similar investment in their networks. So the program we talk about does not include the Munichs, but they ought to be budgeting similarly. In as far as the policy split of 70-30, again, there we're looking for independent power producers, and that 30% refers totally to generation capacity. So it's not referring to distribution or transmission. Who is driving this? DME is driving it. LED technology, yes, that is being looked at as one of our research projects. At this stage, it's an end-use technology more than anything else. And I think if the private sector or a municipality wants to assist end users with that technology, that might be what happens. But we're looking at it as something that would also be part of the efficiency drive, because it is, in fact, a way of getting light at a lower price. The issue of opportunities at local level, we rely on publishing in newspapers. We have the ESCOM website, which has all of the tenders posted, and in that way, information would then become available as to what opportunities there were. We use the media for that. There is history where we have worked together with the mines on social investment, but where there are specific cases, I think one has to obviously look at those. But historically, because of the power stations and the mines being linked, we've always had the opportunity to work on upliftment projects together with the mining companies.
Frequency matters that Zuneet Kotwal is raising. Is there some way he can just communicate to you that these are the minds and these are the people? Because he's a very active constituency. I mean, it's good he's raising it. And then we see whether something can be done. Within 7 days, can you write to the CEO and send me a copy as well? And the board chairperson. We'll facilitate it. Okay?
Nothing to do with SAA. Don't worry. No, not yet. I have some constituents in Flagstaff, not necessarily sitting very close to me, who say that when it rains, they know the power is going to go out there. What causes those kind of problems is the question I was asked. There's also a story about some people in certain areas who say that, they've had reduced electricity, and I'm not quite sure how that works, so that their TVs keep going off. There's power, but not enough to keep the TVs and the kettles and things going. Is that a real thing or is it an imagined thing? And then just two other comments. The one thing, Chester, I'm glad that we are now at last free to admit publicly our culpability in ESCOM's problems or challenges that they're facing, that we are the ones who said that you may not build power stations. I'm glad that get it out in the open, and then the poor CEO doesn't have to not say it every time he gets asked questions. And the wind power, Jefferson. Wind power, ESCOM in the past, they sort of poo-pooed the idea of wind power as sort of a ridiculous, eccentric type of thing. Now, the city council in Cape Town is contracted for wind power from the same people out there. Is wind power a real option? Is it a real thing as far as ESCOM is concerned?
Mind you, sorry, Eric, you can speak, and you know the committee secretary if you want to raise questions. I mean, we're very easy, really, in this committee. We don't have a problem. So, who's left to ask questions? Oh, Sumita, and then? Eric, you got any questions? Chris White? Eric? Okay, after you third. Okay. IFP, you want to ask any questions? Okay.
Chairperson, two questions. One is based from the input by Professor Day. I would like to understand, because there is indeed information that is really not in tandem with what ESCOM says. So I would like to have a sense of what is ESCOM thinking in terms of what is contained here, which is not necessarily, you know, tallying with the understanding that ESCOM has as people who are there. Okay, I was going to say that. Sorry for that. Okay. But what besides the fact that we'll be writing formally on that, say yes, there is this specific question that I want to understand. You know, the document by Professor I say indicates that the demand supply will remain tight for the next 5 years. What does that mean? If there's any truth in it, I don't know. Vis-a-vis the capacity or infrastructural capacity program that ESCOM has. Is ESCOM also speculating indeed that, of course, it could be another 5 years before the tight ratio between demand and supply? And then the last one, Chair, is around the general customer who use electricity. I hear that as the CEO has said, that there is need for customers to really, you know, play their part in terms of assisting in saving as much energy as possible with all the strategies and ways that they're expected to do in trying to, you know, assist in the process. Whether I am right in saying there is a considerable percentage of customers who are not necessarily adhering to the calls by ESCOM, such that that portion of customers contribute a large chunk of percentage in terms of ESCOM not being able to reduce, to deal with the declining margins.
Very quickly, it saves time. You see, on this, I'm not sure, Anton, if I understood you, you said that even with this bill program, there's no guarantee they will achieve the 15% reserve margin. Maybe they can respond to that, right? Because that's the international norm, and that's what I think they're seeking to do. So that's the one. Then there's, you see, like, when you read the more informed journalists, what I keep telling you are the only source of backup we have, this committee, until you've surfaced. Today. Now, you know, everybody says it sounds hell of a nice what they say. They think the problem is that ESCOM's bill program is fine. It's the short term issue. Now, throw a question that I'm asking you because the journalists ask it and they can't speak here. Is the balance between short term and the longer term bill program correct? You know, that's a general question, but maybe you ought to add to it. Then there's, so who wants to speak? Chris Wang and Eric Poskowski. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. I think just wanted to do a quick follow-up on the solar program that the CEO mentioned earlier. We've discussed that last year in committee as well, in terms of getting percentage of renewable energy within our energy sector. And as far as I understand, I think Motorola just signed a contract with MTN three days ago in terms of providing solar energy to their cell stations in the rural areas. So I think that one of the ways to go with the committee is that ESCOM can outline how far is the program and perhaps set up some signs as the way forward in terms of this particular renewable energy. And if I remember correctly, last year there was a research done by Wits University where they claimed that there is a cheaper option. There's a new invention that they've actually considerably bring down the cost of solar panels. Because I understand that, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I understood that the major hurdles of bringing the cost down and also the replacement cost of these panels. So I think perhaps just a way forward is pulling out the committee about more of these programs. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is directed to the DPE. Although the proper respondents might be the DME, that is the Department of Minerals and Energy, maybe you can respond. After the chairman of the board did explain to us about the position of the private sector in the construction of the new power plant, is ESCOM still bound by the 70% in terms of power generation, or there is liability, or the decision has not yet been taken?
No, thanks, Chair. It did come with me because my question was.
Yeah, Chair. Chair, yes, it is a GME process. But we do participate in the discussions, and then we also endorse the decision of 2036 because we do accept that there is a need for private sector to also play. And as Prof has said, it assists around benchmarking, comparing whether ESCOM is doing well or not, but also maybe some innovation can come up, from private sector. So in general, we support the role that the private sector needs to play in the sector, per se. But as to whether ESCOM there is some flexibility around being limited to 70 or 30, from where we sit, would definitely be interested in making sure that there is a critical supply. And for now, the responsibility really lies with ESCOM. Until we get clarity around policy issues from GME as to if you were to limit ESCOM's rollout, in which areas they shouldn't be included. For example, some people would say maybe on gas plants, ESCOM should not continue to be involved, but maybe set that aside for private sector. But that is still rough views that are emerging. GME is currently working out a policy, which we expect that will clarify where ESCOM should not be involved, where ESCOM should be involved, in line with the 70-30 policy. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. The issue about the lights going out in Flagstaff, I wouldn't be able to answer that right now, but I can undertake to follow it up and find out and give a response. I would imagine, though, it's a localized problem. I don't think it's a regional problem at all, but we'll look into that. It could be our area. It could be our area, but at a local level. Similarly, you didn't mention the area, but you said some people have complained that there isn't enough power to meet household requirements. Okay. If we have information, we can look at that. It could again be a localized infrastructure issue. Okay. Chairman, contrary to the observations of the member with regard to wind power, we're the only ones really who have built wind powers. We wind turbines and run them for 3 years now. So this is the fourth year, in fact. We have three turbines at Clearfield, which was built as a pilot project because we wanted to study the technology. So we've got three different sizes, different makes of turbines, wanted to gather data, and to also understand the wind regimes a bit better. As a result of that pilot project, we have now got board approval to build an actual wind farm for 100 megawatts. Now, wind farm continues to be more expensive than either nuclear or coal. But we believe that there's a role for renewables as well. On the one hand, we've got a national renewables white paper that sets out targets that are to be met over a period. So we are actually implementing our contribution to that target. And we also believe that, you know, 100 megawatts does make a difference in a local network, especially the Western Cape, where sources of generation are generally a long way away. So we have made the commitment to actually build that, and we're in the process of identifying suppliers to actually build that. And I think you must remember that's the only wind facility that is under construction, and the only other wind farm that's operating is the one that we built. So we have not underplayed the role of wind.
Yeah, related to this thing, I'll ask this question from a layman's point of view. You know, when you go from here towards Hotiskeel, you see that place, that area. What are the possibilities? What are the possibilities, Chairperson, of constructing a windmill somewhere there by Table Mountain when you go past there? You go to Hotiskeel, that day it's very windy. Even if it's dry, you can hear that it's dry.
Yeah, Chairman, you have made a disadvantage because I don't know the actual spot. But I can assure you that we've looked at wind up and down the coast, both sides. And we're picking the best spots. Because you don't want it just a few weeks in the year. You need to have a fairly reliable flow of wind to justify the investment. But we'll gladly take the information.
Yeah. Asking what can the committee do besides whinging and whining, I would like to urge all members to give me a report, please. I'll also do it. My Vesta is a 1996 Vesta, so it's a good picture of Toyota Army. So, in short, I really think that's a very novel, innovative
way. The morning wind. The beach doesn't see any afternoon wind.
I don't know what's going to suggest that there's a lot of wind in the other chamber.
Chairman, with regards to the observations from Professor Eberhard's presentation, we have concurred and we have said that the situation is tight. And I think we've defined what you mean by tight, because that's something we've been saying for the last 24 months. But but we've illustrated exactly how tight it is. Now, also in answer to an earlier question, I did say that it's important that people understand that what we had in the past, we don't have anymore. We can keep the system going if we all play our part, and I've described what we will do and what we're asking everybody else to do. In that way, I don't think we have to resign ourselves to saying we have to live with this. It is definitely manageable. I think it's definitely within our ability collectively to manage it and still keep life normal. But that depends very much on how successfully one educates and gives people options of what they could do. At the same time, when we pursue every single possibility to improve the situation from the supply side. With regards to whether the plan in the short term is adequate.
Question. Professor Eber suggested that even at the end of the 97 billion rand full program, reaching the 15% international norm. Oh, you don't? Sorry, okay.
Professor Eberhard showed our long-term plan. And if you looked at that, I think there was 1 year we were at 15%, and we're generally between 10 and 15. So we don't sustain the 15%. That is why also then we've introduced what we call a stretch plan. That is outside of the long-term plan. We have identified actions that we need to do in order to introduce a further 2,000 megawatts within the short term, which would then help bridge that gap. Because once it's in the system, then as we add from the longer-term plan, we'll be starting to move towards that. My own view is that in the first 3 years, it is unlikely that we will get to 15%. But if we can implement both the stretch plan and the base plan, I believe within 5 years, we'd be able to sustain levels of 15% or more. So that is the fundamental message that I would like to leave. And I think it answers the question that you also asked. If we were to do nothing but stay with our current base plan, then we will have a problem in the short term. And so we're doing additional measures to find the ways of overcoming that. What portion of customers are responsive? I think the lessons from the Western Cape was that the majority of people responded, and hence that situation was manageable. There is evidence that since then, there's been a slippage, as it were. We're seeing, the inefficiencies coming in again, and therefore it's time we intensify the campaign again. But I must also say that on the 18th, although we're restoring from 11 in the morning and we're starting to get our plant back, what really helped was that when we put the power alert on, because we had to work on it during the day, when it came on in the evening, you could see the response from customers. And so even though we had outages during the day, the evening peak was met. And that just shows you how effective customer response is in this matter. We did not have a problem at peak that evening. Renewable energy, I think I've touched on it a bit. We believe that there's a role for it. In fact, we will be communicating publicly about the portfolio strategy for the next 20 years. And you will see that renewables certainly start to play a role which would be perhaps higher than what is the minimum required in terms of the policy. Largely driven by climate change issues, and we believe that the only way we're going to impact that is nuclear on the one hand and increased renewables. The issue remains the cost, the reliability of some equipment, and we are continually assessing that. I'm told, for instance, that the test that we've done on the solar water heaters that are available has actually shown that there's only one or two products that are reliable. And we therefore have to look at how we can assure manufacturing capacity to make that product available, because the tests we've conducted showed that to be a reliable and affordable product. So there are a lot of issues, you know, and I think it just takes time to get those projects launched because of the testing and evaluation that has to be done prior to that. Thank you.
Kevin, just some closing remarks. I think just to emphasize again that I've no doubt that ESCOM understands the depth and the severity of the challenges we face around electricity security. I think there's also a lot of evidence that they have focused and strategic approaches to dealing with those, including managing the risks. Nevertheless, as I said in my presentation, while the supply-demand balance will progressively improve, it remains tight and the risks are very high in the short term. I've tried to emphasize some of the policy and institutional issues where we can assist both ESCOM and the private sector to improve the situation. And I think in terms of the medium term, particularly in terms of some of the big new decisions that will have to be made, that enabling environment is particularly important. Kevin, one last remark. It's an issue which we've not really covered at all so far, and that is this committee, I'm sure, within a relatively short time, will be start to have to confront the challenge around the implications of all this new capital expenditure on ESCOM's balance sheet and its financial position. We all talk about $97 billion, but as these new projects kick in, you can be sure that that total capital expenditure is going to be very, very much higher. And very quickly, ESCOM gets to a debt equity and an interest cover situation which becomes challenging, to say the least. This means a whole lot of new challenges emerge, but perhaps that's just signaling some issues that you will be facing, I think, in the near future.
Journalists have on this committee, and Business Day in particular. Anyway, very quickly, one is, look, we can't resolve like a strategy and a program in the next 10 minutes, and I don't know that we really need to do it. But what's going to help us is, in the first instance, Eric Boscati is going to do an overview of what happened today. And then Sulani is going to respond to Anton. And then DPE, is there a way you can just give us a one-page, James, that tells us what you have done in response to the report? You say you've done all these things. Can you just give us that report within 7 days? And then we'll give Anton the opportunity, if you've got time and energy, to respond to those reports that we've got. And then we will draw up a two-page like program of action flowing from this discussion so that we also are tighter in what we ask ESCOM to do the next time you appear before this committee. And we're not going to roll you in all the time. There are many things we can do without bringing you in. Secondly, I think very quickly, there's no time. I think I entirely agree with Bali Musa that, you know, let's move on now. We shouldn't whinge and whine about the past. But the truth also is that, you know, this committee needs to apply its mind as Parliament, as a parliamentary committee. What lessons can we draw from the insistence of government, the executive? And the Parliament must also take some responsibility. We failed in our oversight responsibilities around that period to ensure that these things don't happen again. And you'll see in the way we're dealing with the SAA bill at the moment, already we are drawing lessons out. We can engage with the two of you around what we think about state-owned entities and their relationship with government on the one side and Parliament on the other. And you've not been involved in this currently, but we've taken the discussion quite forward. Whether we acknowledge it or not, it's derived from the lesson of 1998 to around 2001. I also agree with Anton. I don't buy this thing. I don't think this committee does anymore. That, you know, the growth rates were... Look, we're going to agree to disagree with ESCOM or whoever changed on behalf of the fund. We just don't agree that if the demand was... if you look at GEAR, for example, it anticipated 6% growth rate in 2001. So really, I mean, you know, it's a weak argument. We've not been convinced, and let's not argue it, James. It's a boring discussion. We can have it outside at lunch or whatever. But James, we have to extract a concession from the minister. When we first raised that, we think it's government that must be held to account, and Parliament, less than ESCOM. But ESCOM also got to ask itself and its board, why didn't they lobby government more? We've discovered from the Western Cape Chamber of Industries, from your colleagues in the University of Cape Town when I was trying to reach you, that you did modeling exercises in 1997-98 that suggested to you very clearly, it was so accurate, that in the year 2000, I don't know, I've forgotten what the figures are, 2005, this is going to happen. And it happened very much around the time. A Chamber of Commerce person from Cape Town or Western Cape rang me to say, you know, we approach government, we approach Eskom. So in short, let's all take collective responsibility, not whinge and whine, let's move forward. There are some things that are very straightforward, man. You know, we've raised this before, James. Can you reply to this thing? This ISEP-NIRP process, why have we got these two processes? We've raised this before. Frankly, Eric just noticed, we want a concrete, practical reply. The committee doesn't even discuss it without a standing position on this thing. Consent possibly shouldn't be integrated. Maybe there are good reasons. Can you give it to us in writing, right? The only observation I would make very quickly, I haven't spoken much, so please, just bear with me. I've got 4 minutes left. Now, you know, Tulani, to use my friend Ololo's famous expression, it's to cover our backs because we maybe think something silly. But it's also true. Half true and half covering for our silliness, right? The point is that as a layperson, to use Chris Ololo, a famous member of this committee's work, the truth is, you know, when you're somebody like me, from the vantage point of a local government activist, sociologist type, I'm not technically prescribed. Unlike my colleague there, my colleague, I didn't do sciences, right? But I'll say to you, you know what I'm... Sorry? Right. But you know what? You know, the systems, Anton, look so sophisticated to us. That's why it strikes us as odd that we are having these difficulties. Because, you know, when you come here, it strikes you as remarkable, your systems, you know? How you're forecasting per hour and so on. I mean, this is like an advanced industrialized country's system. We went to Cuba, we were overawed by what we saw. So it is very striking, I don't want you to respond necessarily, that the system and the technology and the technical capacity is so sophisticated, yet we still have these things. Maybe we can talk outside this thing, right? The one thing I would have liked more about, and maybe we need some sort of one-pager on that from Eskom, this 3,000 megawatts, and maybe Anton, you can also come in there, from business, I think, you want to reduce. We need a bit more concrete than what you've said about what exactly is Eskom doing. Now, for example, a thought that enters my head, as wild as it is, and contingent as it is, for example, when people apply for tenders and government contracts, shouldn't we, or do we, actually see whether they are energy efficient? That should be one of the criteria, or one of the criteria. I don't know if this has been discussed or something, or whether it's a bit wild for me to say it, but can we have Eric and others look at it? Anton, look at this. What can government do to force business, private sector, to have an incentive to deliver on the 3,000 megawatts as an issue? On distribution, I think, Anton, we agree with you. Somebody said to us who's very experienced that you can build all this thing. You can have the transmission line sorted out, but unless you have distribution sorted out, and it's horrific, the progress, and we need to discuss with Nati and Petra and his committee, you know, and even the study group level. Can you put this down, Eric? Yes, Marie. This thing about distribution, there's a meeting taking place simultaneously right now, which is discussing the issue, but we really are very, very worried about progress in that regard and the consequences, right? Then we, James, just tell us something yesterday in the newspaper, yet again, Business Day on page one. The Minister of Minister of Energy said there's a blueprint that's going to emerge by July, I think taking to Cabinet. Can you just add a bit, put some information on that? This blueprint about security supply. Right. Then on communication, we said this before, we think it's very difficult. But the truth is that I don't think the public or even some of the members of the committee are so concerned about the technical side, which you don't even understand sometimes. It's really about communicating to the public and easing their anxiety. And we can all play a role in that regard. And Eric, in our own program, we need to see how we can assist in that regard. This year, we're not going to sit in Parliament very much. So we've got more constituency time. So we've addressed this before. Let's take this forward. What can we do? But we do feel, as difficult and as challenging as it is, we've said this before, that Eskom needs to communicate more effectively. It's not, sometimes when you read the press release, with due respect to the people, Fani and Toronto handle this, very competent, we know. It sounds like a technical explanation. It's almost a rationalization for what's happening. I don't think the public out there is interested particularly in the nitty-gritties of what exactly happened and all the sort of stuff you gave us today. We really think as difficult, and let me tell you, if you handed it over to me, I couldn't manage it either. So I really don't think it's easy. But we think there's more room for communicating to the public, not just timelessly, but more effectively. you know, reaching the emotions and psychology. I don't know how one does this thing. In short, it's been done elsewhere. People have gone to war, you know, in Iraq and so on, by winning sophisticated, formally educated constituencies over by just sheer split. So, hey, we can do it here. And looking at your capacity, I mean, you know, you really, you've shown us you can do it. So we ask you to do it because we have the fullest confidence in you. And in short, just do it. Please, it can be done. I'm also saying that the committee has done its own little bit. I have personally written to the Acacia Park manager, you'll be impressed, Chairperson, to say in Acacia Park, there are too many verandas that have their lights on through the night. When I roll in there at 2 in the morning, or whatever, not that I do it very often, before you want to know where am I at 2 in the morning, I see half the lights are on in the veranda. I have contacted, can you, Eric, write this down? I will contact Ruben Sidumo today, phoning and say, the committee, anybody disagrees, Acacia Park needs to do more? No. So it's a formal resolution of the committee. We have written to the Speaker of Parliament. Although you see the lines get blurred between Mindus and Indina, they think that's their responsibility. So we gave the letter to my comrade Nati Cheshwa and said, follow it up. But we have written the Speaker, Baleka Andete. And quite frankly, the chairperson of ESCOM gets along much better with her than I do. And maybe he should raise it with her. He sees her very often in other structures. And so on, so he can raise it with her. So please, can we think of things we can do? This parliament is not doing enough. Government is not doing enough. For example, I don't want you to answer this. What is government doing? What are government departments doing? You know, you've got the private sector to lower its use of energy. What are government departments doing? You know, not least our own Department of Public Enterprise. Okay. So, look, there's other things that really are things we can handle outside this meeting. But I want to say finally, we want to thank everybody for coming. Not least the chairperson of the board, who I know is very busy as well. Tulani's brought quite a senior team. We are going to congratulate Jacob Maroka. Is that how you say his name? Is that correct, Maroka? He was going to come here for a few minutes, but I think he's caught up in the other meeting. It's really a good sign that Parliament is exercising its effective oversight role. We want to thank Professor Anton Everard, who actually is an extremely busy person. And at very short notice, he made himself available. We want you to come for lunch if you can now. It's here down the corridor. And we want to engage and see whether we can use your services on a more structured basis. Finally, Carol, is Martin Stevens, is there something you want to say about that? Not just yet. Okay. Okay. So thank you all. There's lunch for those who are meant to be here.